This has got to be, I think, my least favourite topic to preach on. The last time I preached on money and giving, I received later on that week through the door a 3-page typed anonymous letter. It wasn't unadulterated praise. In fact, it was, I think, by far the rudest letter I've ever received. So given that, I hope you understand that I'm looking forward to preaching a sermon about money and giving today just about as much as you are looking forward to hearing it. It's a difficult and sensitive subject. And I'm aware in this area, somewhat characterized by wealth and privilege, that I'm stepping onto contested ground. But it's got to be done. This is a crucial issue if we want to be authentic disciples. Jesus taught that money wasn't just a neutral means of exchange. Jesus taught that money was a spiritual power that competes with God for our hearts and lives, competes with God for our worship. He said it's something that we can't love and serve if we want to love and serve God. If we want to be authentic disciples, if we want to love and follow God, Jesus said we must uproot money from its throne in our hearts. He didn't say it would be helpful to. He didn't say it would be ideal if we were able to. He said that we must. I can't remember who it was that pointed out that the Christian needs to go through 3 conversions. The conversion of the head, which usually comes first. The conversion of the heart, which often lags far behind. And finally, the conversion of the wallet, which sometimes never happens at all. So as difficult and as uncomfortable as these questions are, we have to address them for the good of our souls, for the good of our households, for the good of our church. We simply have to talk about money and giving. So how do we become authentic disciples in this area? Well, first, we've got to understand that God gives back to us. If there's a Bible to hand, I would love you to turn to Matthew 6, about page 970, I think, in the church Bibles. And we will be referring on to 2 Corinthians, but I'll tell you the page number for that later on. It's about page 970, Matthew 6. Throughout Matthew 6, Jesus is challenging his disciples to realize that who they are in secret before the Lord matters. It's a call for authenticity. To be in the secret place, people of real prayer and worship. And yet to do that for the audience of one, to be that and to do that for God's benefit alone. Even taking steps to ensure that no one else knows. The secrecy matters because it's a proof of our authenticity. If no one other than God knows, then we can know we're doing it for the right reasons. It's being who God wants us to be when no one else is looking. Jesus uses 2 different words to describe the reward such outward displays of piety are looking for, and the reward that comes from the Father who sees and approves what's done in secret. And helpfully, they're both translated as reward by the NIV. So just work with me. The word Jesus uses in verse 1 and 2, and later on in verse 5 and 16, is a word that means pay. It means wages. In each case, it's preceded by a commercial term of the time, meaning something like to be given a receipt. So the end of verse 2, and both verse 5 and verse 16 as well, could be translated as something like, they've got their receipt as their pay. In each case, whether they're giving, praying, or fasting, in each case, playing to the gallery has got them exactly what they wanted as their reward, the receipt of public praise. That's what they've paid for, that's what they've got. But the word that Jesus uses at the end of each bit of teaching in verse 4 and verse 6 and verse 18 is rather different. And though it's translated the same way, reward, its root meaning is in the idea of gift. Thus, the end of verse 4 could be translated, then your Father who sees what is done in secret will give back to you. It has the sense of repayment, of recompense. It does have the sense of reward, but only if we grasp that it has at its root the idea of God giving back to us. It's not deserved. It's not an obligation as wages are. It's just that giving, praying, and fasting secretly for God's sake alone move God to give back to us. It's generosity towards us aroused by our generosity towards God. I've wrestled with that a bit. It feels pretty close to a prosperity gospel, at least on the surface. It feels pretty close to giving to gain. But I don't think that's what Jesus is teaching here. Why not? Well, partly because the same promise is attached to giving, to praying, and to fasting. So the sense of God giving back to us cannot simply be a monetary one. So how does God give back to us when we've prayed in secret? Well, I think it must be in a greater sense of God's presence, in a greater sense of God's favor in difficult situations, in a greater sense of God answering our prayers and shaping our lives. How does God give back to us when we've fasted in secret? Hopefully it won't be by ensuring that we feel even more famished. I think God gives back to us when we fast through giving us a clearer sense of God's call, through giving us a sharper discernment about people and about situations, through inspiring in us, I think, a determination to keep praying for breakthrough. So how does God give back to us when we've given in secret? Well, not necessarily in kind, but we've got to remember, as verse 8 says, God knows what we need. So that challenges us to trust that as we give sacrificially, we will not go without. So not necessarily in kind, though our generosity will spark God's favor for us and for others. But yes, also sometimes in kind, as God gives back to us as much as, if not more than, we've given. But it's a gift, not an obligation for God. He's not paying us what we deserve. He's giving back to us because he loves our generosity. So there's a difference between a wage and God giving back to us. Whenever we act secretly, we know we're doing it for God alone. And that reality, that authenticity, draws a response from our generous God who gives back to us in so many ways. That's the first part of the conversion of the wallet. We act generously and secretly, giving to bless God alone, and God gives back to us generously in turn. Second part of being an authentic disciple in this area, hearing the call to generosity. The context of the passage is from 2 Corinthians, that's page 1162 and 3. The context of the passages from 2 Corinthians is Paul organizing a collection for the church in Judea. The church in Judea was facing famine and hardship, and Paul felt moved by the Spirit to make a collection to support their brothers and sisters back in Jerusalem. So this is a gift beyond their own locality. This is a gift beyond their normal obligations. Look at verse 8 and verse 10 of 2 Corinthians 8. Paul is essentially saying, I'm not giving you a command in verse 8. And then verse 11, he's essentially saying, I'm giving you my opinion about what's best for you to do. He's not legislating for them, he's advising them. This isn't a matter of obeying a command that applies to all. It's a matter of us responding to God ourselves in the right way. Partly, I'm sure, because this goes beyond their normal obligations. This is free will offerings beyond what they're normally told to give. I don't know about you, but I find that both liberating and troubling at the same time. When we're given a clear standard, we know where we stand. We know what we've got to do. At least then we can think, well, we're giving more than others and pat ourselves on the back maybe, or maybe look down on others not doing nearly as well as we are. But when the question is left open like this, we're left with the challenge to resolve before God what his call is to us. The question is not, am I meeting a standard? The question is not, am I giving more than others? The question becomes only, am I giving what you want me to give? The call to others may be different and doesn't concern me because God may be holding me to a different standard. The question is only, am I giving what you are requiring me to give, Lord? Now, I believe in tithing. We practice that as a family. I believe in giving a proportion of our income. I believe in giving from our surplus, not our leftovers. I believe in all that, but I find these words really challenging. They challenge me to ask, what is God's call to me beyond those principles? At the start of each year, John Wesley decided what he needed to live on and then gave away everything that he earned beyond that point. He didn't want riches to be a snare for him. He gave away everything beyond what he decided he needed to earn to live on. That's a radical response to a radical call. As far as I'm aware, though, John Wesley felt he was responding to the call of God to him personally. At no point did he require that of his followers. He heard God's call to himself, but understood that it was a call binding on him alone. He didn't universalize God's call to him personally. But it shows us powerfully and clearly, I think, what Paul's teaching us here. That we're personally responsible to hearing the call of God to us. God might ask us to give more than others, and we should receive that as a privilege rather than an imposition. Even if God requires that of no one other than you, it doesn't matter. It's still a matter of obedience, as it was for Wesley, for you to respond to that call. The truth is this, the richer you are, the harder it is to dethrone mammon. And doing that, dethroning mammon, might require sacrificial generosity that goes way beyond God's call to others, if your heart and soul are to be free. Money doesn't stop being a spiritual problem for the wealthy. The sense of consequence and importance it gives us, the sense of entitlement and power it gives us, the sense of the right to influence others and change decisions we don't like it gives us. All of those things need to be dethroned and resisted. Several times it struck me while here just how much influence money has over our decision making as a church. Partly it's an aversion to take risks, which I understand. But sometimes it's been an expectation of influence. Several times when contemplating controversial changes, I've been warned by those opposing them that people might stop giving. It's a pattern here, not a pattern I've honestly seen elsewhere. With our wealth can come the expectation that we will be heard because we're people of consequence. And the expectation that it's right to use the influence our money gives us to try and force the agenda our way. That's one of the reasons I think it's so important that hardly anyone knows who gives what to the church. I certainly don't. I might be able to guess if I thought about it, but I don't know. Why? So that hopefully no one has more influence because of their giving. Yet people have tried to use money and influence and the power it gives as a lever here on a surprising number of occasions. To cut mammon off at the root for the really wealthy might require sacrificial and significant generosity. It will also require real humility and surrender, because everything in our culture tells you that if you've got a lot of money, you're really significant. That might be God's call to you. The truth is, the poorer you are, the harder it can be to dethrone mammon in a different way. When you have so little, when you're really watching every penny, it can be really hard to think about giving anything away. That's dethroning mammon in a different but equally radical way. That's being able to trust God to supply your needs, being able to give sacrificially without worrying that God will come through for you. As Hebrews 13:5 has it, keep your lives free from the love of money and be content with what you have. Why? Because God has said, never will I leave you, never will I forsake you. Whether we have lots of money or hardly any, dethroning money is always a matter of trust, and it's always a matter of sacrifice. Afraid Paul's teaching here doesn't get any more comfortable. It's not a command, verse 8, because it's a test of our sincerity in our love for God. The word here means prove by testing, as when precious metals are heated to the right temperature to prove that they can be stamped sterling silver or a certain quality of gold. I'm reminded of the proving by testing that Jesus went through in the wilderness. Verse 9 is not a separate sentence in the Greek. So yes, Paul looks back to the generosity of the Macedonians in verse 1 to 7, but he then also asks them to think of the generosity of Jesus himself. He's saying, I want to prove the reality of your love by comparing it with the generosity of the Macedonians, but also by comparing it with the grace you've received through Jesus. Though he was rich in every way, literally, it says, Jesus impoverished himself so that you through his poverty might become riches. If that's the basis of comparison, frankly, ouch. Just ouch. If that's the basis of comparison, if that's the test of the sincerity of our love, ouch. While there may be no command, there is an example to follow. The example of the utter generosity of Jesus towards us, impoverishing himself to make us rich. Some of you are aware of this situation. I've been dealing with a really difficult situation recently. Many times I have felt tempted to give up. Many times I've questioned my wisdom in dealing with this particular person, whether I've got appropriate boundaries. I've questioned my wisdom in it a lot. And I can't really justify it, except by saying that I am refusing to give up on this person. Even though others think they deserve it, even though the behavior's often been questionable and downright objectionable, he has definitely sworn at me more than any person I've had the privilege of pastoring before. I'm refusing to give up on that person. And when I was praying to God about it, saying, Lord, am I doing the right thing? Is this right? And yet saying, Lord, I'm refusing to give up on that person. The Lord responded to me, just as I refuse to give up on you. Then I understood, I think, more of what God's teaching me through this situation. That God is teaching me to be more Christ-like than maybe I really want to be, frankly. Maybe more than I want to become, if I'm really honest. And when I read this passage, it just leapt out at me. We're called to be as generous to others as Jesus is to us. And that means we're called to refuse to give up on others just as Jesus refuses to give up on us. Despite all the times he's had to forgive us, despite all the times we've behaved badly, despite all the times we have simply willfully gone our own way, Jesus refuses to give up on us. It's that generosity. It's our experience of that generosity that sets the standard for our giving. To what extent is that kind of generosity seen in our giving? And if the heart is right, if the generosity is right, Paul says in verse 12, the amount does not matter. Verse 12. If the willingness is there, the gift is acceptable according to what one has, not according to what one does not have. We are not called to give what we haven't got. We're called just to respond in the right spirit to God's call to us. Being authentic disciples in this area means, third, sowing generously. Verse 6 in 2 Corinthians 9. Remember this. Whoever sows sparingly will also reap sparingly. Whoever sows generously will also reap generously. We could translate sparingly as miserly. The one who sows like a miser watches every seed. Every seed being, as it were, wrenched from them. Such a miser will see only a miserable harvest. I love the literal translation, the second half of verse 6. Whoever sows blessings will also reap blessings. It says something about the joy and thanksgiving that should characterize our giving to the Lord's work. For as the next verse says, God loves a cheerful giver. When we can give generously away, and when we can do so to the Lord's work with real joy, then we know that we have cut off mammon at its root. And then we know that we've really seen the conversion of the wallet, really seen that our money has come under the authority of Jesus. But it's much more significant than that. Yes, we've dethroned mammon, but we've also invited God's favor, invited God's blessing. For again, there's a clear promise. When we sow generously, when we sow for blessings, we will reap generously. We will reap blessings. Wasn't the extraordinary giving last year to save families for children an experience of sowing generously? Wasn't the extraordinary gift that we gave to Open Doors from our Christmas collections a couple of years ago an experience of sowing generously? With Safe Families for Children, we raised so much more than was needed. Wasn't that sowing blessing into so many lives? There are so many promises here. That verse 8, when we sow generously, God will make all grace abound to you. The word translated abound comes from an adverb meaning exceedingly, beyond measure. So if we think of the word abound, if we think of Psalm 23 and God giving us a cup that overflows, if we think of John 2, Jesus creating enough wine from water to frankly float a small boat, if we think of the kingdom harvest being 30, 60, 100 times what was sown, then I think we've got the right biblical idea for the word abound. It's about abundance. It's about us seeking and expecting abundance. When we sow generously, Paul is insisting, God will make grace overflow for us, that we will know it beyond measure, that we will know it in abundance. Grace has nothing here to do with portion control. Grace has nothing here to do with just scraping by. The promise is that when we sow generously, God will respond both by making sure that we have everything we need and by making sure, Paul writes, that we will abound in every good work. That in other words, we will know God's grace and abundance in everything we look to do for him in worship and discipleship, in prayer and in mission. The promises and assurances don't stop there. Verse 10 and 11 promise that our store of seed will increase, that the harvest that will come from our right living and service will grow, and that we will know abundance in every way. Why? So that we can continue to be generous and bring greater thanksgiving to God. Paul challenges us to seek and expect abundance. So being an authentic disciple means when it comes to money and giving, understanding that God gives back to us when we seek him secretly in giving, prayer, and thanks and fasting. It means heeding the call to generosity, even when the call to us personally might go way beyond what God requires of others, being challenged to learn from the startling generosity of Jesus himself. And it means learning to sow blessings as we seek and expect abundance. I wonder how this challenges you. Is it to head back to the secret place, knowing that God values your giving, praying, and fasting when it's done just for him alone? To head back there, knowing that God will give back to you in so many ways the investment you're making? Is the challenge to set Jesus' own example as the standard by which to test the sincerity of your love, the standard by which to measure your generosity? Is the challenge to seek God for his call to you beyond the keeping of rules like tithing? Is the challenge to dethrone money from its pride of place in your heart and your life? Has your wallet also been soundly converted along with the rest of you? Or is the challenge for you to seek and expect an abundant harvest? In what are you investing yourself that has a genuine kingdom heart and purpose? And are you paddling about in it, or are you in it right up to your neck? How invested are you in it? I'm aware this is contested ground when we have so much. I'm aware that it's difficult ground. I'm reminded of Malachi 3, where the Lord says, "Test me in this. Test me in this. Try me out in this. See how I respond." So how invested are we? How generous are we? How much are we seeking and expecting an abundant harvest?